For the week of May 16th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 54, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. Still in Cannes, France, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
Still in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And still in Cannes, France, I'm Michael Goetz.
So yes, Michael is not only in Cannes, France, he's actually sitting right next to me here. And when he's not sitting right next to me, we're usually sitting right next to each other in a movie theater or sleeping right next to each other in a bed. I think we kind of beat that joke to death last week.
Now Karen, if you were in Cannes, what would you be doing? Would you be trying to go to parties or would you be trying to go to movies? Would you be networking? How would you make use of your time?
I would be going to movies and I would be probably people watching and hanging out on the beach, hiding, of course, from all the beautiful bodies.
Nobody goes on the beach.
Really?
No.
That is not true. There
are
French people
on the beach. I'd be somewhere by the water.
Well, you're always that.
No, but I mean like sitting like right there, like looking at it. I would not be networking. I would not be going to parties. I'm the most boring person alive.
I have not gone to a party here in quite some time. Certainly little cocktail receptions, yes, but there are years that have gone by that I have not gone to parties. And quite honestly, and we'll talk about this a little later, here in Cannes, for the festival this year, there seems to be, probably due to the economic crisis, but very few parties.
Absolutely.
At least very few parties that we're invited to.
I was just going to say.
Hey. Of course, the first big party of the festival, which was not big at all, I don't hear anybody talking about it, was Robin Hood.
I talked to somebody about that, actually, and they attended it and said that they wish they had not.
I was just saying, it's kind of indicative of the movie itself.
Yes.
Hey.
Well, and we should be talking about the movie a little bit, because it was released not only in the United States this week, but also throughout the world. So we're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about some television news. We have some cancellation news and some pickup news. Of course, we're going to be doing some music news and Big Deal, Big Whoop. The music news we have to talk about today is on the teenage side. So stay tuned for that. We even have a little tiny inside baseball snippet. But as always, we turn it over to Michael Goetz first so that he can fill us in on what happened in the North American box office over the weekend and hopefully a little international to go with it.
Well, rock crushes scissors cut paper, and iron crushes hood. That's what we've learned, I think. Iron Man 2 crushed Robin Hood. I'm a little surprised in the U.S. Iron Man 2 goes to another $53 million. It's at $212 million in the U.S. alone. And it's about dropped 59%, which isn't bad. It's the 13th biggest second weekend of all time. I mean, there's so many stats now. It's like baseball. It's just crazy. They're like, that's the second best third Friday in, 27 years. But it's doing great. But I always say people have to step back. The only numbers that matter is how much did it cost to make, how much did it ultimately gross worldwide, plus on DVD. That tells you all you need to know. Robin Hood was number two. It grossed $37 million in the U.S. It doubled that overseas, grossing $75 million. So overall worldwide, this first opening weekend, it grossed $111 million, which everyone is saying, oh my God, what a disappointment. I think it'll have good legs overseas. I'm not sure what's going to happen in the U.S. That's a scary opening. Number three was Letters to Juliet, a romantic film that's not based on a Nicholas Sparks novel, the first one in a while. It grossed $13.7 million. Just Right was at number four. That grossed $8.5 million. That's the Queen Latifah film. And at number five was still How to Train Your Dragon with $5.1 million, $207 million in the U.S., $400 plus million worldwide. It's a success. And then 6 through 10 are just holdovers like A Nightmare on Elm Street, which is falling fast, but it's already at $56 million and it only costs $35 million to make, so there will be another sequel. And then Date Night, which is at $86 million total. The Backup Plan, which is at $34 million. Furry Vengeance, which is just a disaster, at $15 million total. And at number 10, Clash of the Titans, which is at $160 million in the U.S. and another $450 million total worldwide. So obviously we saw a ton of films, but none of them at the box office. Karen, did you go to the movies? Did you hold up your end?
I did indeed. I saw Just Right, of all movies.
Oh, how was it?
It's darling. It's really cute. I mean, it's nothing you haven't seen before. You know, it's pretty cliched, but Queen Latifah is likable, and Common is incredibly sexy, and it's just a really enjoyable movie.
She's a star. She really is. She's a very appealing presence on camera.
So you're saying Just Right is just that.
Just Right is Just Right.
All right. You didn't go see Robin Hood because you could feel like you were at Cannes. You could pretend because you could see it just like 2 days after us.
Yeah, no, I missed Robin Hood. I thought about going to Letters to Juliet, and I actually wanted originally to go to Iron Man 2, but I lost out. Just right it was.
Well, it seems like a lot of people missed out on Robin Hood, and I think it was on Box Office Mojo that I learned it was somewhere. Medieval-themed pictures typically disappoint at the box office, as Mr. Scott found with Kingdom of Heaven in May of 2005, but Robin Hood mustered the top grossing start of all time for the subgenre. I love the fact that it's a subgenre. It surpassed the last dramatic Robin Hood movie, which of course was Prince of Thieves. It doubled that take overseas, grossing 75 million. Oh, you already said that?
Well, you're just reading what I wrote, because yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, you wrote it, so I didn't want to, you know, all those words I thought were like mammon-esque.
Waste the time, yeah.
Yes. you know, I was really surprised at how quickly Iron Man dropped. It dropped 59%. And I was also surprised 10,000 screens it was on.
Why is that surprising?
Because usually you hear, oh, it's on 3,500 screens. But
a lot of screens.
No, but it's on 4,300 theaters. It's
You know what? That's a worldwide thing, I think. It's on 10,000 screens worldwide, and they did not point that out on Box Office
Mojo. No. It's if 10,000 screens on 4,300 theaters. They always talk about the theater count. They're saying at that theater it's on 5 screens, 6 screens. Another theater it's on 4 screens.
So they're saying, so basically,
10,000 individual screens. Yeah.
Well, right now, that would mean that if that was 10,000 in North America, that would mean that Iron Man was playing on 25% of the screens in North America.
No. How many total theaters are there in North America? Theaters, multiplexes.
Oh, I don't know about that, but they're saying 10,000 screens. There's 40,000 screens in the U.S. and Canada.
Multiplexes?
Screens. Auditoriums.
No, individual auditoriums.
Right.
Oh, well, I bet that's true. Well, you go to any multiplex, I bet half the screens opening weekend were Iron Man. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I mean, if that's the case, then...
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
That's a sad statement, but, you know...
I agree. There's something off about that.
Yeah, I mean, 50...
I mean, it's wrong, but it's a little screwed up.
No, it's not screwed up at all. It means everyone gets to see the movie opening weekend. You don't get sold out screens. They can expand and meet demand. If nobody was going, they would have given it to Robin Hood or Letters to Juliet or How to Train Your Dragon. They have flexibility now that they never had before. When people keep buying tickets, they can just push another movie to a smaller screen. It's all good.
Well, Michael, do you think any of the movies we've seen over the past week, and we've seen, I've probably seen a good 12 movies. I mean, there was one day I saw 5 movies here.
I saw 5 today.
Really?
How do you find the time? What time do you guys get up?
You don't want to know. I mean, the first press screening of the day, which today was
Beautiful by the director of Babel and 21 Grams,
Iñárritu, and it was I believe his name is Alejandro González Iñárritu. But it was starts at 8:30. All those press screenings start at 8:30 in the morning, whether you are there or not. And usually, you are there in body, but not in mind because you're asleep.
Oy.
And you always have to go to the first screening because it's one of the big movies in competition, and it's the one, it's your best chance to see it. And you know, you got to get there at 8 too. You can't show up at 8:20 and walk in and get a seat, or it could be sold out. Depends on the movie. But for a lot of them, you got to make sure you're there early. So you got to get up at 7:30, 7:15 and get out there, grab a croissant, go into the theater, sit down, and then read the trades for half an hour. And you've got to be there because it's one of the big movies of the fest. And then it just goes on from there. You've got 100 different screenings. You can just pick and choose which one overlaps with what, when you're going to grab a bite to eat. And you just sort of stagger them through the day based on interviews and time to write and just do what you can. Some days you only go to 2 or 3. Other days you go to 4 or 5.
So how does it work? Do you have to like buy a pass to go to a certain number of movies, or do you pay per movie?
No, we have press credentials. So, you know, the festival goes through an accreditation process starting in February and March of each year, and then they receive all of these requests, and then they accredit members of the press. This year, I believe there were 1,500 journalists, and of course, then there's all the technical people and photographers. So it gets up there. It's about 4,000 members of the press. Not all of them are critics. Not all of them are writers. Not all of them are television reporters. But they're working with the media.
Well, let's bring on our guest.
Yes, we actually have a guest. We also call him a house guest and a roommate, and... Well, his name is David Bourgeois, and he's here in Cannes writing for Movie Line. And are you writing for any other outlets?
I'm just writing for Movie Line on this go.
Now, you've been coming to Cannes now for a number of years, since 1992.
That is correct.
Really?
Yeah. My first year was 1992, and I actually covered it for Spy Magazine, the original Spy where I worked and interned for a while. So that kind of started the ball rolling, and I've been going to Cannes on and off since 1992. I haven't been going straight through, but yeah, it's been a fairly long run.
Well, obviously, you've seen a lot of changes coming to Cannes over the years. There have been periods when there were huge parties and tons of media, times when you could get interviews with anyone you wanted, and they were happy to give you half an hour. Looking at this year's Cannes, what are the trends you see in the industry as a whole, or what's happening? What's going on? What do you see reflected here at Cannes?
Well, I think this year, and I think Sperling mentioned this a bit, is that I think the economic situation has certainly played its role this year. Last year, I think some things were down. I think attendance seemed to be down. This year, there seems to be a ripple effect, and what I've found, at least so far, is that there are certainly fewer parties, and I know you guys had also mentioned that there are. And I think just in general, there probably are fewer films at the market, and all in all, seemingly a quieter year on the Quasit.
But is it quiet creatively? Because all that other stuff reflects the industry. But as far as the movies at the fest, I'm having as good and interesting a year as I usually do.
Yeah, I think maybe for me, it's so far, you know, we are at exactly the halfway point. So I think that. I for one am hoping that the second half is better than the first half. So far this year, creatively, I haven't really been blown away yet by anything that I've seen. You know, I think, you know, there are probably two or three films that I've liked. There's, you know, there's probably 10 films that are so-so and a whole bunch of others that are just kind of no good. So
I'd have to agree with that. I mean, I've come to this festival now, I think, well, let's put it this way. The first time I came, the number that started the year was a one. So if since the 1990s, I've been coming to this festival. 2003 was a horrific year. I mean, all the films were bad. They were just, it was one bad film after another. People were really complaining.
Give us some examples.
I think the best film that year that everybody liked was Dogville by Lars von Trier. Everything else
that's
was...
That's a good movie.
That's a good movie. No, I'm saying that was the good movie. And this year... It's not as bad as that, but there's nothing that makes you just jump up and go, wow, that was unbelievable, like you did when you saw Dancer in the Dark or when you saw, you know, Diving Bell and the Butterfly. You know, there's
in the Mood for Love.
In the Mood for Love. Yeah. There's nothing like that.
Definitely.
Now, Karen, you know me. Dave agrees. Sperling agrees. What am I going to say?
I'm going to say, Michael, you think that this year is just the best. So many good movies. So many good movies.
Well, you know, every year people go to Cannes, they look at those, say, oh, it's boring, it's the same old directors, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you see a lot of bad movies, especially in the first day or two, so you get really depressed and worried. You think, oh, my God, I'm never going to see a good movie. And you're tired, you're jet-lagged. And, but then by the end of the fest, no matter how bad, I'm sure from 2003, I had two or three of my favorite movies of the year I saw at Cannes. And, you know, it takes 10 days, and you might see 30 to 40 movies. But if you can see three movies that are among the best of the year, then it's a good year as far as I'm concerned. And I've already seen three movies that will be on my short list for the best of the year. So let's get to the question of what your two or three favorites are so far.
I believe some of the films that I've liked is a Romanian film called Tuesday After Christmas. I know, Michael, you and I talked a little bit about this. Just a wonderful film about a couple... the couple are about to split up, and there are some excellent takes in the film. There's just some excellent acting. It's a very subtle film. I'm certainly hoping that it sees the light of day in the States, though you know how these things are. This could be the only screening of it, and then it could go away. I certainly hope it doesn't. That was one of my favorites.
Very long takes in that film.
Very long takes, yes. Maybe going like 3 or 4 minutes with just one camera take.
They can't really afford editing in Romania, so they have to choose their images.
Right, right. And then, you know, I know we also talked about this, but I think that the Iñárritu film, Beautiful, certainly up there. I think it's certainly the best film he's done. I was not a fan of 21 Grams or Babel, and I think...
And so you're talking about Beautiful right now.
Beautiful, yes. Yes, indeed.
That stars Javier Bardem.
Javier Bardem, and yes. I think that's pretty much the only name that anyone would probably know is Javier Bardem. So that's good. And of course, just now to go to the other side, the worst. I mean, of course, I think this is the Robin Hood, far and away, just a dreadful, dreadful movie.
Why?
Bad casting and just terrible writing. There's just nothing in the film that really holds any joy at all. So that certainly kind of gets my award, my award for worst film. And that is a fairly easy film to kind of beat up on.
It's the opening night film, which is just to bring in the stars, right?
Yes, right. So that's, you know, certainly up there. And then there's just like a whole bunch of films that were disappointments. Really, more for me to say I really had hoped better, and which was the Takeshi Kitano film.
From Japan.
Which was called Outrage. Yeah. Sorry, I'm still kind of getting up on this. Outrage was just a miserable bloodbath. In probably 100, 200, 300 people were killed in that film.
And that sounds great.
Various ways, but none of it was entertaining or insightful or interesting. It's a
Japanese film made by a Japanese director who is actually known in Japan as being a very comedic actor on television. But when he makes movies, he makes them about the Yakuza. Mafia in Japan.
Mafia, yeah.
And so he spends the first 20 minutes of the movie introducing you to a number of people, all Yakuza related, and showing you where they fall in the grand scheme of things and what the hierarchy is. And then he spends the next hour and a half in each scene killing one of them. It's just, or like chopping their fingers off. It's just remarkable how, like, you just knew by the end of that film, well, okay, this is where he gets killed, and this is where he gets killed, and this is where the other guy gets killed.
Not a comedy?
No, it's not a comedy, although there are comedic moments in it, believe me.
Yeah.
It was hilarious. So, Sperling, what were some of your favorites?
Well, I'd have to go, and I had forgotten. This is what it's like. You see so many movies that you forget some of the good movies you've seen. Now, the movie that you mentioned, The Tuesday After Christmas, from Romania, very understated, very slow-paced, loved it. I really did think it was very strong. And I have to thank Steve Zajcek of the Los Angeles Times for telling me to go see that film. I never would have seen it otherwise.
Did you just drop something? Oh, yes, you did.
A name?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I'll try to drop names of other journalists if that will impress you. What else did I see? I did not like tonight's movie by...
No. Tell us what your favorites were.
Okay, Inside Job was...
What is it?
It's a documentary about the Wall Street crash and the economic crisis by Charles Ferguson, who directed a movie on the occupation of Iraq, No End in Sight, previously. This is a fantastic film for anybody that wants to know anything about how we wound up in this quagmire, this economic quagmire. It's chock full of information. It's directed really well. It's a lot of talking heads, but it moves like a bullet train. I mean, it just never stops throwing figures and facts and incidents at you. I mean, and it's a huge eye-opener, even for people like myself who knew most of this stuff. It really does. It's a very comprehensive look. There are some things that are maybe small flaws, but overall, a very good movie. I also really liked the Mike Lee film, even though it's slow and deliberate and it's not a very happy subject. And I don't even know where to begin on what that movie's about, but basically...
Life.
It's about life, like all of Mike Lee's
Sadly,
films.
Sadly, it's about my life, but keep going.
It's about a single woman who is in her 50s, probably.
40s.
40s.
Late 30s,
40s.
Yeah.
And now Mike Lee is the director that did Secrets and Lies. He never has a script. He always is improvising. Improvising through rehearsals and then he shoots it. It's the story of this woman and how alone she is and how she's gone through a divorce and how desperate she becomes, set in England, Mike Lee's home country. And it's also about the people around her and her friends. But it just... how would you describe this movie? What would you say the theme of this movie was?
I would say it's great. You're somebody who's in your 30s or 40s and you're watching your life pass you by. You see your friends with children and a home and a happy career, and you don't have any of that. Hello, that's me.
Yeah, no.
I was just going to say, okay, this sounds like the story of my life.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is. I also liked it a lot, and it does seem to be. It does seem to make some kind of sweeping statement on kind of married life versus single life. And I'm not sure if Mike Lee had ever really intended that to happen, but he seemingly is kind of positing the idyllic married life versus the kind of, you know, sad, lonely, single, I have nobody. And you know, certainly there's a whole lot more going on in the film, but you can't help but walk away from that film kind of thinking like, wow, I mean, he's really kind of, in one essence, really kind of slamming singlehood.
See, that kind of stuff really pisses me off.
Yeah, well,
it's not so much marriage as just you can be happy, but it's probably easier to be happy with someone in your life. You know, right. If you're happy on right. your own, great. But
exactly.
Most people aren't, and they show that, I think.
Right, and he really does show that. I would say another film that I liked was Tamara Drew, which
yes.
I liked it.
What?
Yeah, it's a light, frothy Stephen Frears comedy.
It's light.
Frothy. And you know why? Do you know why straight men will love this movie? I'll give you two words. Can somebody tell me the name of the actors in that film?
Gemma Arterton or something.
Atherton, yeah.
Not Atherton. It's the Bond girl. The Bond girl.
Yeah, she was in Quantum of Solace. And let me tell you something. I could watch her all day
There's
long.
There's not a bit of skin in it.
There
so don't get excited. You don't see her breasts.
You do see her.
Side of her breasts.
You see them. They're there.
There's very little skin.
All right, there is little skin.
I don't know. She was wearing those Daisy Duke jeans at one point. I mean,
oh, that was cute.
Short shorts.
But I still think the best actress in that film is the
little teenager,
the girl,
yeah.
The girl who is played by. She's actually in the film. She's playing a 15-year-old. She's 17 years old in real life, and her name is Jessica Barden.
Well, we should explain what this movie's about.
Yes.
It's about a you explained it really well, Michael.
Yeah, it's based on a graphic novel by Posey Simmons. It's about a woman who goes back to her mom's cottage in her hometown. Her mom's died, and she's cleaning up the affairs and wants to just, you know, move on. She's a journalist for a top newspaper. She has a weekly column. She's very personal, you know, writes about her own life. And she's had a nose job, and she was sort of a dorky kid, and now she's blossomed into a beautiful woman. And she loves using her sex appeal to get revenge on the people who wronged her in the past. And there's a pop star in the mix, and there's a writer's retreat nearby. And it's all very light and bucolic, but I thought it was a total misfire, personally. But there you go.
I would have to say I think you stand amongst the few on that one.
That movie's not commercial. That won't make any money in the U.S.
Well,
I wouldn't pick that up, would you?
No, but I think it is. I mean, it is going to be picked up.
Oh, it will be released, but it won't make any money.
No, I mean, it certainly. I mean, I.
Right. So, what? And those are your favorites.
Well, Benda Bilili, which is about which opened the Casin de Realizador, which is
Sperling,
the director's Fortnite. So yeah, it was a documentary about a paraplegic, homeless Congolese band that made it big. And
it's a true story.
It's a true story. It's like unreal. But it took 5 years to make. That was very engaging. Got a standing ovation at the end of it. Of course, the people were there, so that helped. The musicians, that is. And I would have to agree, beautiful. I liked it. I know a lot of people who had problems with it, but I would say in general, more people liked it than hated it.
Yes.
And there are some people who just feel like Inuratu is the most pompous, egotistical, and you know what?
Which
they're
he
right.
Is.
Which, they're absolutely
yeah,
right.
Which he is, and certainly at the press conference, he you know, kind of strutted his stuff and didn't really lay to rest those rumors, but...
Yeah, he's known for kind of saying,
yeah.
you know, just pompous things. But, you know, I like him a lot, and what I was really disappointed by was the Woody Allen film.
Ugh. Why? He has barely made a good movie, and well, his last great film was, you know, 20 years ago.
No.
Great.
Match
great.
Point.
Not a great film.
I would say Match Point is a great film.
Right. Vicky Cristina Barca.
I love that movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Besides that,
it's
20
mean,
years. It's
Vicky Cristina Barcelona?
No, are you kidding?
I wouldn't say it's great. I would say
great?
That's a mild chuckle.
Well, okay.
But this one, yes.
Well, speaking of mild chuckling, let's cut to the videotape here and go to an audio clip of Woody Allen talking about his feelings and thoughts on life.
This is my perspective, and has always been my perspective, on life. I have a very grim, pessimistic view of it. I always have, since I was a little boy. It hasn't gotten worse with age or anything. I do feel that it's a grim, painful, nightmarish, meaningless experience, and that the only way that you can be happy is if you tell yourself some lies and deceive yourself. And I'm not the first person to say this or the most articulate person on it. It was said by Nietzsche. It was said by Freud. It was said by Eugene O'Neill. One must have one's delusions to live. If you look at life too honestly and clearly, life does become unbearable because it's a pretty grim enterprise, you will admit. So that is the way I feel about it, and we can discuss this privately later.
Talking to some critics afterwards, they were saying pretty much that they thought that Woody Allen, you know, says these things, but he's got a pretty good... He's got a pretty good life. He's probably pretty happy. So he kind of likes being, being like pampered, and he likes all of the trappings of being a fairly, well-known director.
Human. How could he not like
True.
It?
True. But so it just kind of course, rings hollow when he's saying, oh, life is miserable. It is a total shtick. It's like a stand-up shtick, which it's funny. He's a stand-up comic. It's funny. I mean, I was at the press conference. He was very funny.
He was asked about death and his relationship or thoughts on dying, and he says, "How's my relationship with death? Not good. I don't recommend it."
Yes.
It's an oldie but a goodie.
Yeah.
So my favorites really quick are, I love the Mike Leigh film. There's Imelda Staunton, who was up for Best Actress in Vera Drake, I think. Didn't she get an Oscar nomination? She has a 5-minute performance at the beginning of the film that's so indelible, you spend the rest of the movie waiting for her to reappear. But I think it's a beautifully written, beautifully done film. And I think the lead actress in that movie,
Leslie Manville?
Manville. I think she'll be a contender for Best Actress because, you know.
Yes.
My other favorites include definitely Inside Job, the documentary about the Wall Street meltdown. I thought it was very lucid, entertaining, thorough, relentless.
It's this year's Inconvenient Truth, without a doubt.
Yeah, it's like what you want a Michael Moore movie to be without any of the goofiness that lets people dismiss Michael Moore and what he's saying. So that's the nice thing about that. And then I loved the movie I saw today. It's by the Chinese director Jia
Zhangqi. Good luck trying to say that. I mean, these are names that are near impossible to pronounce.
Hai Shang Shangqi.
Right, and the name of the movie translated is what?
It's, I wish I knew. I wish I knew.
And the director is Jia Zhangqi. Jia Zhangqi.
Yeah. So my favorite film of the festival was I Wish I Knew by director Jia Zhangqi. He's from China. One of his recent films was Platform. His movies never get shown in that country because they deal with stuff like the Cultural Revolution and people in Taiwan and Hong Kong that China does not want you to talk about. So he makes these beautiful films that never get seen in China, but he still works there and they don't approve of them. But he somehow gets them made. The New York Times Magazine had a great profile of him and how he does it. His new movie is almost a documentary. It's mostly a documentary about China and people's lives. And then it's intercut with movies. It's a very unusual, odd duck, but it's beautifully made and nobody liked it. Nobody there liked it. People walked out the whole time. It's pure art house. It'll get played in New York City at like one screen for a week and then it'll be gone. But it's a really lovely, beautiful film. And then in other events, there are Critics Week and Directors Fortnight. I liked Ben Dabalili. That was a fun movie.
That's the documentary.
I saw two good directorial debuts. One was by the woman Katel Kilverer. It's called A Violent Poison. It's a coming-of-age tale about a girl who's about to reach her confirmation, and she's confused because she's more interested in the boy next door than she is in being confirmed, and she thinks that's wrong. But it's not. It's just natural, as they would say in France.
Au naturel. Which is how she was in most of the movie.
And then a Mexican film called We Are What We Are, which is about a family of cannibals.
Yeah, it's called the Mexican cannibal movie here.
Yeah.
The dad dies, and he always procures the bodies for them so they can eat. And now he's died, and the family's panicking, so the two sons have to step up to the plate and start bringing home some bodies so mama and sister can have their dinner. And it's very serious. It's sort of like the vampire film Let the Right One In. And it's not as successful as that by any stretch, but it's a very good debut, very interesting and very fun. And then there's Kaboom by Greg Araki, which is totally ridiculous, sci-fi, college teen, sex comedy, end-of-the-world apocalyptic film. People call it the
Greg
CW
Araki's
on
still
S.
around?
Yeah.
He's very, what do you mean still around? Still he just around. Did Mysterious Skin and Smiley Face, two of his best movies. Yeah, this is sort of like
no
his,
comment.
This is sort of like his, yeah. You didn't like Mysterious Skin?
No, I'm Kaboom.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I won't defend Kaboom, but I had fun at it.
And that's pretty much what most people said. Now, a film that most people hated was Matthew Almeric and...
I hated it. Now, not most people.
No, everybody that was not French hated this movie.
And the movie is On Tour.
On Tour.
Is the name of the film.
Yes.
Tournée in France, in French, rather.
And Almeric is a very well-known actor in France. He would start in the Diving Bell and the Butterfly, so...
Yes. But yes, the film, and we should just maybe say a little bit about the film. It chronicles the tour of some American burlesque performers touring along the coast of France. Matthew Almeric is the stage kind of, I guess he would be the
manager, producer.
Yeah. And he kind of takes them around these small towns in France. And there's lots of burlesque shows throughout the film. There's...
I would say that's one of the themes of this year's festival is breasts, usually bare.
Really?
Yes. I mean, that and there's an iPhone in every movie except Robin Hood.
I think I may have seen an iPhone in Robin Hood, but I'm not sure which scene that was.
Well, the nice thing about Tournée is it shows the divide that happens at the fest. The Americans all hated Tournée. And then over the last two or three, I mean, it's incredibly boring. I don't think it'll even get picked up for the U.S. I mean, nobody will show it. And over the last few days, then I heard French people saying, oh, very good. I love that movie. That's so good. And then every day you go to the trades. You go to one of the two or three major hotels, and you grab the Hollywood Reporter, Variety, and then different magazines you never see otherwise, like Screen International and Le Film Français. And they have a rundown of critics from different countries. Screen International is more geared towards the U.S., and Le Film Français, obviously, is geared towards the Europeans. And you look in there and you say, oh, my God, people liked Tournée. Yeah. And you realize this movie that everybody you think despised it could end up with, like, a top prize at the film festival.
Well, speaking of top prizes, who do you think – I mean, who? Which films do you think at this point in the festival, halfway through, are contenders for either the grand prize or the top prize, the Palme d'Or, the Golden Palm?
Take it away, Dave.
I'm going to, you know, that is a tough one because we still have yet to screen Ken Loach.
I'm talking
Ken
about
Loach.
What we've seen so far.
I know. So yeah, I will try to see what I can kind of muster here. But certainly, as we've been saying, Mike Leigh is, I think, on the short list to win a director's nod. I'm not sure that his film is quite up there to win a Palme d'Or. I would be surprised. Certainly, Beautiful is the kind of film that really could just kind of come in and take the Palme d'Or. Javier Bardem could get an acting award. But other than that, you know, the in competition films have been pretty unremarkable. So as I said, the second half, I think things are going to really kind of kick in, and I think there's going to be some major kind of breakout films coming up.
There always are.
You know, I think that something that I forgot to mention that I liked and I think that is on the short list is the Chinese film by director Wang Xiaoshua. Yes, I did just butcher that name and I apologize. Chongqing Blues is the name of the film, and it's about a father who returns after, I think, 7 to 8 years being gone. It's his son that died? Yeah, his son has died. And was murdered by a police officer, but in a hostage-taking situation where his son had taken somebody hostage. And so it's a very elliptical story told through a security tape, and basically the father is realizing that his absence in this child's life has led this child to become a grown, you know, 19-year-old who is... he's rudderless. And the funny thing is, he has a new life with a new wife and a new son. And so it's kind of, he comes full circle. It's kind of interesting.
I would just say on that, I don't know if I'm legally liable if I say this right now on the air. I will give you $1,000 if that wins any award in the Cannes Film Festival. I mean, I'm saying this
did you hear that?
This is now I'm liable for this. But I would be so incredibly shocked if that film wins an award. It would. I mean, listen, I had some problems with it. I didn't love it. I thought it was fine. There are some major holes in it. I think it's a kind of an interesting concept, but I to see this jury headed by Tim Burton giving that film an award, I would be frankly shocked.
No, frankly, Entour has a better chance.
And that's the important thing to remember, Karen, is like who is in the jury, because it's headed by Tim Burton. So he wants something freaky and out there, and doesn't matter what the American press or what the European, all that matters is those 5 to 7 people on the jury.
We have a ton of news to talk about. I know that, you know, we're here in Cannes and it's kind of dominating our lives. Karen, are you hearing about any of this news back in the States?
Not a lot, actually. Yeah, Nikki Fink's been reporting, and there have been, you know, little pieces here and there. But for the most part, we're focusing on the upfronts. Yes. We still are talking about the iPhone getting stolen.
Oh,
still
yeah.
Talking about that oil spill, which is just dominating the news these days.
Well, actually, Michael and I may be in Cannes next Monday, or at least I will, because...
Of the ash cloud?
Yes, thank you very much. It was a...
Not me, I take the train.
You're going to somehow take the train over the Atlantic? How does that work?
London.
Oh, okay. All right,
awesome!
No, I'm
in London for 2 weeks.
All right, well, and when are you? Yeah, I'm flying back Monday. I'm actually flying back a week from
I fly
today.
Back on Saturday. I'm just like, you know, please just hold on until like next Thursday. Then you can, well, you know, for like a week until Michael has to come back. Blow your lid or whatever you want to.
Hey, come on. This is a family show.
Whoa.
Well, thanks for being on the show, Dave.
Hey, thank you guys for having me.
And what's your Twitter account so that we can plug that?
Or do you have a website?
Whatever. My website is davidbourgeois.com.
How
and
do you spell it?
David, D-A-V-I-D, bourgeois, one word, bourgeois.com.
I love your last name.
Oh,
love
thank,
it.
Thank you. I made it myself. And my my Twitter account is just dwbourgeois, one word. So there you have it. And I'm covering... for movieline.com through the end of the festival. So thanks a lot, you guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, you just mentioned upfronts, Karen. We should probably just jump right into that. So if we had any segue music, we would play it, but we don't. So we'll just go right into the upfronts, which upfronts, if anybody needs to know, is when the networks announce their new shows and which shows have been canceled for the fall season for, in this case, 2010, 2011. Law and Order. The big surprise was canceled. So after 20 years, the big cornerstone of a show was canceled. Apparently, the show was averaging 7.3 million viewers in the U.S. with a 1.8 rating between among adults 18 to 49.
But what I think is really interesting there is that not only have they kept SVU, which does better, but they're
Lola.
Extending the franchise to Law & Order Los Angeles.
Lola, as Michael just said.
Lola.
I guess somehow the below-the-line costs, they couldn't shrink anymore? Because obviously they rotate the actors in and out, so they don't cost a lot.
Yeah.
I don't quite get that either. And I'm really bummed, obviously, because Dick Wolf always had his goal of, from like year 12 or 13 when I interviewed him, he was talking about beating Gunsmoke. And being the longest running drama in TV history, Gunsmoke ran for 20 years. Law and Order was about to run for 21. I mean, Kelsey Grammer just beat the James Arness on Gunsmoke because he played Frasier for more than 20 years on television on two different shows, but Cheers and Frasier. So he beat his role of playing the same character on TV for the most seasons. And now Law and Order was poised to beat it. And at the last minute, it's just going to have to end up be tied. Though it will come back perhaps for a series of TV movies or a miniseries, some way of giving the show a goodbye. They're talking about that now, but it's a bummer.
Well, we also have some other NBC news. It turns out that the network will be canceling both Mercy and Trauma to medical procedurals.
Not a good time to be in a hospital.
Yeah, not a good time to be whether you're sick or an actor. Not a good time to be in the hospital. That's very true. However, they did spare Chuck. So this is the popular kind of nerdy show.
Semi-popular.
And they are going to, so that will continue to air on Mondays with two new shows, The Event and Chase. I have no idea what those shows are about.
I'll tell you.
Please, please.
I was afraid of that.
Okay. Because I looked this up because, you know, I'm obsessed. Okay. The Event is a conspiracy thriller that follows Sean Walker, played by Jason Ritter, an ordinary guy investigating the disappearance of his fiancée, thereby exposing the biggest cover-up in U.S. history.
See, that sounds like a terrible setup for a series. You know, it sounds like a miniseries or a telenovela, but not a four. Are they going to tease out her mysterious appearance for 5 years? What a nightmare.
The other one was Chase, which will be airing at 10 o'clock on Mondays.
And that's a cat and mouse hunt as a team of... Not even a sentence. Cat and mouse hunt as a team of U.S. Marshals track down America's most dangerous fugitive. And Kelly Giddish, whoever that is, stars as U.S. Marshal Annie Frost.
Okay, well,
it's Bruckheimer, though. It's Bruckheimer.
Okay, well, we probably shouldn't go through all of these shows, but...
Was there anything that stuck out for you, Karen, that you liked or that you're looking forward to that's new?
You know, none of these really get me excited. I think Outsourced, which is one of their comedies, will probably be funny. It's about an American company who outsources its call center to India. It's like, if you've ever been involved with a company that did something like that, you'll understand why it's so funny. I bet the Friends with Benefits will probably be sort of funny, but that's sort of hit or miss. My best guess for a hit is going to be Undercovers, which is the J.J. Abrams show.
Yeah, well, and obviously ABC and Fox unveiled their schedule. I don't know if there's any big news on ABC. I'm surprised they renewed V. It just keeps falling. Obviously, they canceled Scrubs and Flash Forward. We'll never know what the heck that kangaroo was doing. Are you upset about that?
It was a good show. It was funny.
Yeah. Is there any new shows of ABC's that you're excited about? They've got Jerry Bruckheimer's The Whole Truth, A Legal Thing. They've got, you know, My Generation, an ensemble thing. Michael Imperioli of Sopranos and a cop dramedy called Detroit 187.
I think Mr. Sunshine is supposed to be really good. That's the Matthew Perry one. He's a sports manager. And I, a couple of weeks ago, met the wife of the creator of Detroit 187. So just because I liked her, I'm going to say, go Detroit 187. I think that's the one that stars Katie Sackhoff, and I like her.
Well, they also canceled the Romantically Challenged. You probably said that already. But Alyssa Milano said... I just spoke to ABC. They say that no decision has been made as of yet.
Aw, sweetie, they just haven't told you yet.
And Zach Braff announced that was the person who announced a couple weeks ago that Scrubs was canceled on Facebook.
Well, good God. I mean, that's just a mercy killing.
I love the fact that he called it new Scrubs. Scrubs 2.0? Question mark. Scrubs with new kids? Scrubbier?
Scrubbier.
Scrubs without JD is no more.
Oh my God, I have to start following him. He's funny.
Yeah, that was funny. And Fox unveiled their schedule. The best news for me is that the American Idol results show will be half an hour rather than an hour.
Oh,
they won't be padding
yay.
It. So that is, it means less fast forwarding through whatever I've DVR'd. So that's good news.
What's The Good Guys? What's that new show?
The Good Guys is they've been advertising the hell out of it. That's the show with Colin Hanks, Tom Hanks' son, and another actor whose name I can't remember. And it's a buddy cop show.
Yeah, whenever I drive past the Fox lot, it's got the big billboard spot, and you're just like, oh, God.
And I'm a little worried about Glee. They say Glee's not going to have that big hiatus anymore, but it sounds like they're going to start in the fall and run through the spring. That show should be a limited run, you know, like start in the spring or start in the fall, and that be it. Because that show cannot run for 24 episodes. You know, that's just too many episodes for that show. It's a very complicated show to do, and I think it should be like,
who's going to write all that music?
Yeah, well, the music's written, but it should be like 20 episodes in the spring or the fall, run consecutively, and that's it. Don't they know how this works?
Well, you know, I think it's very interesting that, you know, all the shows that kind of went away and then came back, except for Lost, which is ending, you know, they tend not to do very well. V was picked up, which is a little surprising, as you mentioned.
It's not surprising, because it did great.
Oh, it did great. Okay. What was the other one? Fast Forward. You know,
killed.
It really killed that show. The fact that it
you can't
stopped.
Do it.
You can't do that. People forget.
Wait. Lost is ending? I don't know anything about this.
Yes, Sperling, are you now going to rescind your outrageous comment that you thought it would beat and set the record for the top highest grossing series finale of all time and beat MASH?
I will not rescind it, and you will find out why in just a moment.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I'm tempted to jump to that story right now.
Go right ahead, sucker.
George Lucas wrote a fan letter to the cast and crew of Lost. He wrote a nice note saying he didn't know how the Star Wars series would end, but acted like he did. He talked about how much he liked the shows, it was read at a party for the cast and crew, and at the end, co-creator Damon Lindelof reportedly said, "I just want to apologize to Mr. George Lucas for everything I said about the prequels."
It's going to be lucky to break 20. It'll break 20 million, I think, at the finale. But it's,
I think so
it'll
too.
Break 20 but million.
But you said 104 million.
Oh, is that how much?
Mash, yeah.
Oh,
sorry.
Yeah, but you know what? You have to really take into account that things have. The viewership has changed a lot since MASH, so I'm not even sure that it's a fair comparison.
It isn't, because of course most people like myself will DVR it and watch it weeks later.
That counts. It gets registered.
Now, is this going to be Peter Rice's first year as the chairman of Fox?
That's a good question. I wanted where to say it was
the
second.
Where he's in charge of the schedule?
Yeah, I mean, he ran Fox Searchlight and did a phenomenal job. He picked up movies like Garden State and Slumdog Millionaire. But
yeah, you know what? I think it's his first. Yeah, I think it's his first pilot season.
Yeah. Okay. So this is his first kind of go at working in television, and you know, I certainly hope he is as successful as he was in film.
I like him. I think he's really smart.
He's so nice. I can't even tell you. He's so nice.
Then he won't last a year.
We are running over because we talked too much about one particular subject. So we're going to talk very quickly about. Music. Baseball players turn to teens at plate. That was the headline for this story, and I was like, what the heck is this about? But actually, it's about Justin Bieber, who, of course, anytime you say his name, your ratings go up.
And
so.
Miley Cyrus.
Apparently, baseball players are using Justin Bieber's music when they step up to the plate to bat. And Justin Bieber was at a White Sox game last week, and when Mark Tihan came to bat, Bieber's baby blasted through U.S. Cellular Field. And the Yankees' Nick Johnson, Colorado's Troy Tulowitzki, and Florida's Cameron Maben have all used Miley Cyrus's Party in the USA at the plate. And most of them are saying they're using them as jokes, and then they kind of go back to their regular hip-hop rock, classic rock song.
That's not true for Nick Johnson. I was in Yankee Stadium opening day, and...
That was the day he used it.
He uses it repeatedly. He still uses it. Oh, he uses it all the time because his teenage daughter asked him to. But what happened was he stepped up to the plate, and the players all choose their song, and they usually have two or three that rotate while they come to bat. And he steps up to the plate, and suddenly we start to hear Party in the USA. I'm in the bleachers, and everyone turns around and looks at each other like, what the F? And people are going, that must have been a bet. He must have lost a bet. And everybody's laughing, and he hit a home run. And then we're like, Party in the USA.
Song.
We were all waving our hands in the air. And then he came up the next time. We're like, play it again. And it came out later that his teenage daughter had asked him, said that was her favorite song. So he played it for her.
Aw, that's nice.
Well, the other little tidbit of a story here on teen singers was, have you heard of this singer, Charisse, I think her name is?
Of course.
Yes. Don't you read Entertainment Weekly?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't.
I've seen her on Ellen. I've seen her on Oprah. I've watched her on YouTube.
Apparently, she's been on Ellen numerous times, and she's been on Oprah for at least four times. And so she's doing quite well for herself. And
her debut album comes out this week. She's a YouTube sensation. She's this Philippines teenager. Celine Dion is met. Oh, she's adorable. Celine Dion is mentoring her. Like Celine Dion, she has just a big, big voice. She's not... an interesting singer, but she can belt it out, baby. And who knows what she might grow up to be. But basically, she's stepping into the Celine Dion role, and she's had so much exposure on TV. It's sort of like the Scottish woman from Britain's Got Talent. My God, what's her name?
Susan Doyle.
Susan Boyle.
Yeah. It's very much like
how
that.
How quickly
where,
we forget.
Yeah. Very much
my
like that. Where
relaxation music?
That I gave you for Christmas?
Yeah.
That's awesome. It's going to be fascinating to see how she does because, you know, obviously album sales are so far down these days and she's not a person who's selling singles. She's really just looking to sell albums. And it'll be interesting to see how well she does.
Well, let's hear a little bit of her. Let's see if I can hear. Here she is. You know, earlier today I played this and it was basically she was on Oprah and it was her being introduced. Now, frankly, I think this is a very good thing. I was able to see who she was. I now know who she is. I now know that she was on Oprah, so it gives Oprah a little publicity. But instead, it says this video is no longer available due to a copyright claim by Harpo Inc. So Oprah took it down.
She wants you to go to Oprah.com and watch it. I'm sure it's there. But if you go to YouTube and search for Charisse, Charice, and Celine Dion, you'll find Celine Dion introducing her in concert, and it's like, and they duet, and it's just such a... I mean, Celine Dion is the most sincere person in the world. It'll drive you insane. It's very funny. She is the most beautiful. She's like an angel down from heaven. But it's funny, so you can check her out.
Well, we're running behind, so we're going to just whip through some of these big deal or big whoop things. That's right. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our popular segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. The first story this week is about NBC. NBC has banned The Hollywood Reporter from attending its fall schedule announcement. Why? Because it snuck into a rehearsal and leaked NBC's entire fall schedule online days in advance. Karen, is this scoop a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, first of all, that reporter doesn't need to go to the upfront announcement because he's already got all his info.
And they're keeping them from interviews and stuff.
I know, right? You got the exclusive. I don't think this is a big deal at all.
Michael, you're right. I say the ban is a big whoop. I think the scoop is a big deal because that's their job. Find out what the fall schedule is in advance of their competition. So good for them.
And they were in a hotel. It wasn't like they broke into someone's house.
No, right. Exactly. They didn't commit a crime. They wandered into the convention room.
But anyway, moving on to Saving Private Ryan on Blu-ray. Or I should say we're not moving on. Paramount recalled last week's Blu-ray edition of the Oscar-winning Saving Private Ryan, which is directed by Steven Spielberg, because the audio and video were out of sync. Bombs and bullets could be heard falling before they were actually seen. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I say it's a big whoop, but what's interesting is how little this happens. It shows the good quality that, you know, the good quality control there is on DVDs and Blu-rays. You know, this is so unusual that people are mentioning it. So that's a good sign, but it's a big whoop.
Karen, what do you think?
I think my chuckle just probably explains that I think it's a big whoop.
Okay, then. Moving on to Comcast. Cable giant Comcast just cleared the new channel ESPN 3D for its digital tier. ESPN plans to offer about 100 3D events in its first year. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop? Never mind. Michael, is this a big deal or...
No, that was a good call.
I kind of know your answer.
You lost me at ESPN.
No, it's a big deal. It's another step forward. They feel the need to launch an entire channel devoted to 3D. I don't think it's ever going to work in the home, but it's definitely an interesting thing. So it's a big deal for them trying to make this happen.
Gigantic waste of money.
Yes.
Moving on then to, well, let's go 2,000 leagues under the sea, because now there's not just... Oh, we are really sophisticated here. That's our soundboard. Probably won't have to wait to see 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea as a rebooted film. Of course, the first film was way back in the 60s, I believe.
50s.
In the 50s, okay. Director David Fincher, the man behind Fight Club and Zodiac, wants to have a little fun. He's talking with Disney about directing their franchise, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And now, of course, this was the same franchise that McGee was going to direct for Disney, and Disney canned it. Rich Ross came in and said, nope, we're not doing that. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think this is a big deal because I saw here, you know, in the show notes, David Fincher to direct 20,000 Leagues for Disney, and I was like, I thought they just canceled that. So this is a huge deal. This is a real diss to McGee.
Yeah, I'd have to say you're right about that.
And I think it's a big deal. There's a competing project, obviously, at Fox that we heard about after this was announced. Fox is trying to do their own version with the guy who wrote the script for Clash of the Titans. There's a good call. And they're getting director Timur Bekmambetov, who did Wanted. The pretty good...
And that is a good call.
A pretty good thriller with
Liam
Neeson.
Call.
But it's a good franchise because, you know, it's got that whole environmental angle because Captain Nemo was sort of like the Shark Wars guy of his day. He was attacking shipping and people who were doing whaling and things. You know, he was very environmentally friendly. So I'm sure they're going to have that angle. But how bizarre that David Fincher's doing it. They were worried about the McGee film because it was too dark. You know, it was like a Batman Begins type take on it. So they said, who can we get into lighten this up? David Fincher.
The thing about McGee is that he's sort of a loose cannon on his films. I mean, he's not the best director in terms of not only just whatever you think of him creatively. He doesn't completely have control over his sets. So when you hire him to – I know, sue me right now. When you hire him to do a movie, you take a lot more into account, you know, with the director than just the creative style.
Remember, this is the guy that had Christian Bale go off on a tirade that was recorded and released when he was directing the Terminator Salvation movie.
And Christian Bale did not have a particularly bad reputation, right, before that?
Not to that extent.
He did.
Right. So,
he kind of had a minor one, but not like that.
So we might blame the director.
Speaking of loose cannons, let's move on to Shia LaBeouf, who is sorry. Very sorry. He's here in Cannes with Wall Street 2, but he says he's sorry for Indy 4. It should have been better, he admits, and George Lucas confused or what? I don't know what.
why would you apologize for a sequel being bad?
Well, Michael, is this a big deal?
Why did it come up?
Well, he was not only apologizing for Indy 4, but he also, at the same time, I mean, he must be here without a publicist or something. The fact that he apologized for that and then apologized for Transformers 2. Now, and what he said about what did he say about?
He said, when I saw the second Transformers movie, I wasn't impressed with what we did. There were some really wild stunts in it, but the heart was gone. And the third sequel is going to restore a human element that got lost in the second movie.
and he said about,
oh my God.
Yeah, he said about Indy 4, I think the audience is pretty intelligent. I think they know when you've made slop. And I think if you don't acknowledge it, then why do they trust you the next time you're promoting a movie? We had major discussions. He means Harrison Ford, wasn't happy with it either. Look, the movie could have been updated. There was a reason it wasn't universally accepted. We need to be able to satiate the appetite. I think we just misinterpreted what we were trying to satiate. And so is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal as far as you say, as far as not having good control over what you're going to say and all that sort of stuff. I don't think it's too loose cannon. I think he's right that audiences are smart. They know when a thing, if everybody agreed that Indy 4 was bad, and we all did, there's nothing terribly wrong with him saying that. It's the way he did it, and including Harrison Ford in it is not smart. Let Harrison Ford speak for himself. And comparison Transformers 2 to 1 is really a stretch, but there you go.
Karen?
Can he apologize for Even Stevens while he's at it? I agree that it's a big deal only because, you know, he really needs to be reined in. Like, there's saying, I didn't think the movie was all that great. And then there's going off like he did.
Our last story in Big Deal or Big Whoop is about the Dave Matthews Band. And if you want to see them perform live, you should probably do it soon. The Dave Matthews Band, which is just about always on the road, after about 20 years of jam banding around the world, they're taking 2011 off. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal for a Dave Matthews Band. They must be exhausted.
Karen?
Big whoop. Bands do this all the time.
Okay, then. With that said, let's move on to our next segment, Inside Baseball, in which we discuss the news stories only people in Hollywood might care about. And frankly, I work in Hollywood, and I could care less about this story, but it is kind of
why
important.
Why are we doing it?
Well, because it is kind of important. Do you know anything about this story, Karen?
No.
Yeah, Michael's shaking his head no. You do. You want to take it?
Oh, do I know it well enough to explain it? Okay, well, Carl is Icahn? I don't know how to say it.
Carl Icahn. Okay. He's a
Icahn?
Well-reputed corporate raider and equity investor. He kind of goes into companies and takes them over.
And he's been trying to do just that with Lionsgate. And Lionsgate has been trying to push back on him. And it's just been going back and forth on both sides until finally today Lionsgate agreed to give him Icahn a spot on the board, and that apparently is going to be enough for him. I mean, there's just it's a corporate raider going after control of a little, you know, movie studio, and it's kind of too bad because I think Lionsgate is really great, and I would hate to see what would happen with somebody else, you know, at the helm, especially somebody who's known for being, you know, a corporate raider.
Well, is it poorly run, Lionsgate, or what's the rap on it right
no,
now?
No, it's very well run. I don't know why he's going after it.
Well, he's going after them because he believes it is poorly run. And they did something kind of silly. They bought TV Guide.
Oh, that was stupid.
Yeah, they did
what
it like.
They pay for that $1 billion
yeah,
or something.
I think it was like ridiculous.
Did they buy the magazine or the website or the both? They did. They bought the magazine for the website, right? Wasn't that what they
did?
Yeah,
and the channel, the cable channel.
Yeah, the cable channel. That's what I meant. The cable channel. It's ridiculous. The magazine is so. Their readers are all 70 years old.
Yeah,
it's
there's no reason to buy that.
It's and given away free
I
by every newspaper
TV Guide.
In the country. There's nothing to read.
Actually, I know people who read
so
it too.
Not true.
Well, he owns 19% of the company's stock, and he was trying to take them over because he felt that they just weren't being run properly. And in March, he made a $6 per share offer for all the outstanding shares and to buy all the stock and basically own the company outright. And it was rejected because the stock was trading at $6. So it wasn't even being, you know, he wasn't offering to buy it at a premium. He then offered $7 per share. And what Michael Burns, who's the vice chairman and, God, I'm forgetting the head. I'll have to look it up. But the senior management of the company held a stockholders meeting and took a poison pill. And what that means is they took a vote on whether to accept this offer or not. And if the answer was no, then it was going to be very hard for Carl Icahn to go to other board members and convince them and other shareholders to convince them, hey, you should really take our offer. And that's exactly what happened. Now, this is kind of so Carl Icahn had no place else to go at this point.
So will he just try and fire the head of the company, or what will he do? Because he can't dismantle it, obviously, because he's only one guy on
well,
the board.
Well, firing the head of the company is going to have to come through the board.
Right, and but so, he's on the board.
Was
well,
he sits on the board now, but he's just a member of the board. But
is it him, or is it one of somebody he nominates?
Well, he won't. Yeah.
It's usually somebody he would nominate.
Yeah,
I don't think we know that yet.
Right. And I think his...
It just strikes me it's incredibly ironic because of all the studios I've ever dealt with, Lionsgate was always the easiest to deal with. They made, to me, were smart choices. Yes, the TV Guide thing is a little questionable, but... Given their past, I'd give Lionsgate the benefit of the doubt. That's the only thing I found really fascinating about this story.
Well, of course, they just released Kick-Ass.
Which I like.
And Why Did I Get Married 2?
From Paris with Love was a big flop. The Spy Next Door was a big flop. Daybreakers was probably okay for the dime.
Either way, it looks like, Karen, you've just updated us. They've reached an agreement. So the current senior management will stay in place, at least for a little while. And we're going to stay in place here
right
in Cannes
can.
For at least another couple days.
Do you miss us, Karen?
I do, terribly.
once more, with veracity.
I do, terribly!
Oh, very good. now, we were going to try and record a few special episodes here, but we have been so busy that the recording and the editing and the... I don't know if we're going to be able to do it.
Right.
We'll try, but we might not get to it.
One musical comment. One of the best films at the fest is Inside Job, the documentary film about the meltdown on Wall Street. And there are about four or five pop songs used in the film, like Taking Care of Business and Peter Gabriel's Big Time and MGMT's Congratulations. So congrats to them for prominent placement in one of the best movies of the year.
Yes, and I should say that you can actually hear their music, if you'd like, on whoismgmt.com, their website, or on myspace.com/mgmt. Now, the reason Michael mentioned that is they provide the music at the beginning and end of each of our podcasts here. And if you want to learn more about them or our podcasts or any of the stories that we talked about during this episode, then please go to showbizsandbox.com, our website, and you can look them up in the show notes for episode 54. You can also find ways to contact us. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. You can call us toll-free. 888-567-SAND is the number to call. Again, that's 888-567-7263. I think that's about it. Of course, Michael Giltz can always be found on michaelgiltz.com or on Twitter at Michael Giltz is the username to look up. All of the writing that he's doing for all of the outlets he works for will be posted there, right, Michael?
Yep.
If you want Cannes coverage from Michael, michaelgiltz.com is the site to look up. If you want to find more information and writings and learnings and teachings from Karen Woodward, go to karenwoodward.com, and you can
sign up for my classes. What?
Teachings? Yeah.
Hey, man.
You know, I thought you were a guru now.
It's like 1 o'clock in the morning here.
Snarky 101.
Yeah, well, you know, you can also follow Karen on Twitter, at Karen Wood. Oh, no, it's at Karen underscore Woodward is the username to look up. Thank you for making that so difficult to say. I can be found on Twitter as well.
Hey, somebody's already got Karen Woodward.
Okay. My Twitter account is at Sperling, so you can follow me there, or you can follow the show at Showbiz Sandbox is the username to look up. Some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie. And until either next week or until we post a special episode, play nice.
Say it in the Woody Allen voice.
You have to lie to yourself all the time. The only way to get through it is, you know, it's a horrible existence. Yeah.
Life is meaningless, horrible, depressing.
But this is nothing new. I've been saying this for years, and now everybody finds it that I'm getting older, and they think that's what I. But I, you know, Nietzsche said it, and Freud said it, and now I'm saying it, and it's like that.
You know, I was.
Oh my God! You're so awesome.
Screw the clip. We're just going to use that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes! You guys should be done with that. Sued.